Hello and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Going into the legislative session, how to pay for the escalating cost of rail was the overshadowing issue. Now, with one more day left in the session, whether there can be any agreement on how to do it is setting up a cliffhanger ending. The proffered plan by the House on Friday to increase the transit accommodations tax to 12% met with resistance from the Senate, which prefers the extension to the general excise tax. Yesterday, an amendment by Henry Aquino, the chair of the House Conference Committee, advanced only a 1% increase to the TAT. Curiously, though, both Friday's and yesterday's House announcements mentioned that members of the hotel industry had been consulted. Earlier today, we consulted Mufi Hanneman, president and CEO of the Hawaii Lodging and Tourism Association, and I asked him if that included his organization.
That was not the case. The Hawaii Lodging and Tourism Association represents over 170 hotels, and we are the largest private sector visitor industry organization in the state. No one in my capacity in working here, my staff, or our officers were consulted, so we were very much in the dark, like many legislators that first heard about the first proposal, which was a 2.75% increase last week, as well as the latest one that was proffered yesterday at 1%. We were not consulted or apprised or part of the loop.
And do you have any idea that anybody else in the hotel industry might have been?
I think it was Hawaii Tourism Authority, because they were going to have a press conference and they had invited the president and CEO of the Hawaii Tourism Authority to that press conference. But if he was consulted, he did not apprise any one of us with respect to what that position is. And so we convened an emergency meeting yesterday with our officers, our chair-elect, and our incoming chair, and we all came to the same conclusion that we remain steadfast that the TAT should not be the funding source for rail. They should take it from the general excise tax.
So why wait until yesterday, as opposed to when this came out on Friday?
We went on the record on Friday.
But we didn't get any public response, at least the press release, until Monday?
We immediately responded on Friday when we heard about it, as like everyone did. We were very active in making sure that they all understood this, because, as I said, the first idea to do a increase of 2.75, we heard about it 11:30, and we immediately expressed our sentiments, as well as went on the record, issued a statement that we were opposed to it. We did not wait. They knew all about it. In fact, we were very active in trying to get one of the houses, if not both of them, to go back to the general excise tax as the funding source. And so the net result, which was happening in the Senate yesterday by 60-9 vote, we were very involved and actively involved in making sure that we could have at least some elected officials take that position of the general excise tax.
The counterargument is that if you use the general excise tax, then it becomes disproportionately unfair to the elderly and to those who can least afford it, poor people, etc. How do you answer that argument?
Well, you know, no one wants a tax increase of any sort, but if you look at all the options, whether it's the real property taxes at the city, whether it's the general excise tax, or whether it's the transient accommodations tax, you need to also look at it in terms of the fairness argument. It's not just the tourists that have the opportunity, I say, to ride rail. It's basically being done for the local residents of Hawaii to give us another option, another alternative. And I've always maintained, whether I was mayor or now in the private sector and heading up the Hawaii Lodging and Tourism Association, that's the fairest tax to bill rail, because the tourists pay it as well as the local folks pay it. And I really believe that's not a major tax hit at all. Yes, I'm very concerned whenever we talk about our most vulnerable parts of the population that are going to be assessed a tax of this sort. But, you know, it's a matter of fairness to us. That tax for the tourists that we assess for our tourists is a tax that should be going for tourism-related purposes. I fail to see the nexus directly with rail, because it's not even going to Waikiki yet. And secondly, that they're trying to also take monies to set aside for education. As much as we all want to support education, that's another raid on the transient accommodations tax. And the economy is going to start to slow down with respect to tourism numbers. We all know that. We're starting to see that. And more importantly, the GET is a more reliable source of funding. The TAT is highly volatile. If you get 9 million tourists, there's no guarantee you'll get 9 million tourists the following year. It could dip. It could drop. Whereas the general excise tax is much more dependable, much more reliable, and I think it's fair.
That said, would you be open to any sort of compromise in increasing the TAT a little bit? I mean, as we saw yesterday with the Aquino amendment, would that at all be something that you would entertain if it came down to either doing it or not?
It would be nice to be at the table. It would be nice to be asked our opinion and then sort of sit down. I mean, we all want to, see projects in our community succeed. We all want to see a better quality of life, but we have to be at the table. We can't be told after the fact, and that's the problem that we have here, and also extends to members of the legislature. I mean, you have the legislators from the neighbor islands who are kind of concerned about this TAT assessment, because one of the arguments that they put forth to oppose it is that neighbor island hotels are going to pay the TAT, but it's not going to be any direct benefit to them, because it's going to go to pay for the Oahu rail system. And I think that's a very fair argument. So what they all need to do is we have to sit down and not just have a few make these decisions, but, get everyone's input so we can all figure out, what we can put on the table and come up with a common sense solution that will be fair, equitable, and something that we can all support.
Do you have any idea why you're not at the table?
Oh, I don't know.
Have you
I don't have to be at
all?
The table. It could be other members of the industry, but they have to have standing. If the conversations were held with the Hawaii Tourism Authority, we go to bat for them big time, because it's all about protecting their marketing funds. Anytime you talk about taking marketing funds and divert it for another general fund purpose, we're right there defending that. So if they are consulting with the Hawaii Tourism Authority because they control the purse strings and the marketing funds, then it's incumbent upon the Hawaii Tourism Authority to touch base with the Hawaii Lodging Tourism Association, the Waikiki Improvement Association, all the other stakeholders, so that we can together, collectively, figure out, how's the best way that we can help the state.
Have you called them to engage them at all and say, hey, why didn't you even bother to ask us?
Well, fortunately, there are members of the legislature that are reaching out to us, and that's why you saw what happened yesterday on the Senate side. Those that agreed with our position had consulted with us. So, props to Senator Kai Kahele, for example. He reached out. Senator Lorraine Inouye, she reached out. Members on the House side, Representative Sharon Haar, Representative Marcus Ashiro, who support the argument that we've been making, that the general excise tax is the tax that you should rely on. And here's what people on Oahu have to keep in mind. Even with what was offered on the TAT, Mayor Caldwell came out immediately and said that was not enough. And so when pushed to say, well, where are you going to get the additional monies from? He said, I may have to go to real property taxes. Now, I can tell you, whether you're the most vulnerable part of our population, if you own your home or your middle class or wherever you fall in that segment, the real property tax is going to definitely hurt if that's what they're going to do as an alternative funding source rather than the general excise tax.
Right, and all of us are going to have to be considering all that. But back to your point about having everybody come to the table together, if discussion like this is going to happen or a potential amendment happening last minute, is there a sense that you are being shielded from this or not engaged purposely?
No. I think everybody is well aware of where we stand. We are an education advocacy organization. And so I'm not going to stand pat right now that they're at a deadlock. I'm going to work very closely with other like-minded legislators that would like to see a general excise tax as the option. And we're going to see, whether, in fact, we can find common ground. I think right now is a prime opportunity for the governor of the state to step in, because the legislature is at an impasse, and he needs to demonstrate strong, courageous leadership, take a position. And if his position is the TAT rather than the GET, then it's incumbent upon us to figure out what's the best way to do this. If his position is the general excise tax rather than the transit accommodations tax, then those who oppose the general excise tax have to figure out what's the best way to do this. The rail is too far gone. I know folks who don't like it want to see it stop. They want to see us go back. They want to see us return the money. But it's going to happen. It's a question of when. I've always said this, the longer we delay, the more we're going to pay.
A question of when and a question of how, and very clearly, if it's going to be through any sort of amendment, they only have a day to do it, so I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion today, and we'll be hearing more tomorrow. I want to thank you for the time today.
Thank you very much, Bethan. Aloha.
Mufi Hanneman is president and CEO of the Hawaii Lodging and Tourism Association. We spoke earlier today. Later in the morning came the announcement that at 1 p.m. the governor will hold a news conference on the legislative session. A letter dated today from the four county mayors is asking him to extend the session to resolve House and Senate differences over the rail bill.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, preparing budding journalists for the rocky road ahead. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we remember a small offshore island that was primarily used as pasture land until it became a key military site. It has a surface area of about 500 acres and is about a mile and a half in length. It's surrounded by water that's deep enough to accommodate deep ocean-going vessels. It has an especially colorful history in pre-contact times as the scene of a game that would likely horrify the missionaries when they came to the islands. The game began with a gathering of commoners and chiefs around a bonfire. Toward evening, the leader would chant a song and men and women would form a ring around him. As he chanted, the leader would touch a woman and a man, and they would go off into the shadows to spend the night together. Even when married couples took part, their marriage vows were suspended during the game, and they would often spend the night with different partners. When the sun came up, they would return to their spouses. By the 1820s, the missionaries had put a stop to this scandalous activity, but its memory lives on in the Hawaiian name of the island. Today, we're looking for both the English and Hawaiian names of this small island. We'll be back with them in the second half of the show, but if you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and if you're first and right, you just might get the prize.
Aloha, I'm songwriter Tim Rose, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
How do we prepare the next generation of journalists? Today's journalists face an entirely different climate than their predecessors of even a generation ago, in real danger overseas and routinely discredited at home, not just at the highest levels of government, but by the public at large. Budding journalists will have to learn ways to earn back the public's trust, and that's a challenge Hawaii Baptist Academy student newspaper advisor Eunice Sim faces every day. She's with us in our studio to share her strategies for doing just that. Hi, Eunice. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Do your students, are they aware of this climate for journalism where they're routinely described as purveying fake news?
Very much so. I think all of them are so connected to what's going out there through the social media channels that they're on, and they're very aware of what's being said out there about the news, about the media, and also sort of their they're watching, you know, what's going out there.
You know, when the internet first came along, I think a lot of people in journalism thought it was going to be a wonderful way to share information, and it's more of a rumor mill, isn't it?
Yeah, I think what is a little bit scary is that because you can sort of choose what you want to read, and sometimes the site that you're on sort of shows you what they think you want to see, we sort of end up just looking at things that you agree with. Right.
Sure.
You don't look at a variety of things anymore. You listen to what you like to hear. That's the danger, I think, of like really smart media and technologies out there.
Well, you know, I was just thinking about the history of what is now called fake news and the fact that a lot of so-called legitimate journalists have been discredited. I'm going all the way back to Janet Cook in 1981, who had to return her Pulitzer Prize because she won it for fake stories. Judith Miller's reporting in the New York Times about weapons of mass destruction, on and on. You know, I mean, in fairness, journalists have done a lot to discredit themselves, haven't they?
I think, on one hand, you know, journalists are humans, you know, they make mistakes. But at the same time, you know, that shouldn't be an excuse, right, to do poor work. I think all the more because there is so much responsibility in a journalist's hands when they write and when they publish something, that all the more it should only make journalists want to become better at their jobs, which to me means checking your facts even more than once if you have to, being sure of what you publish, and I think many times checking your motives before you do something.
That would seem to be perhaps the trickiest part of it all. You know, we all tend to skew toward the things we want to believe, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I think with my students at school, whether or not they're journalists or any class that I'm teaching, I think a value that I want them to learn at growing up as a person is the idea of being self-aware. And honesty and humility with yourself. We all have our opinions. We're all passionate about things, and sometimes we feel strongly about certain things, which is great. I think that makes us human and alive. But I think what I want them to have always is the ability to check themselves and say, yes, I feel really strongly about this, but can I kind of be critical about my own opinion and realize that I might not know everything and that maybe sometimes I could be wrong. And I think that is a very, very valuable thing that I want my students to learn as they grow up, whether or not they become journalists or not. I think in every profession, that makes you a quality human being in my opinion.
Sure. And yet, you know, as you said, people are not going to be absent of opinions, but it's the whole thing that they used to say in various newsrooms I've been in, you know, save that for the editorial page. So now you are writing, let's say you do have an opinion that you want to express on the editorial page or in an editorial environment. You still got a responsibility toward the facts, don't you?
Yeah, for sure. Just as an example, at our Eagle Eye, which is the name of our school newspaper and our website, I tell them that, yes, you can express your opinion about pretty much any topic because we are a real newspaper, so to speak. There is freedom of press and speech. You know, we believe in those things. But I tell them it's not that there are any topics that are out of bounds. But if you want to write about something, any topic, I expect you to have integrity in your writing and in how you do it. And so it's not that there are taboo subjects, but if you approach what seems like a taboo subject, I actually have a very, very high standard for you if you want to do that. Because I think that if you have a strong opinion that you want to express, don't just preach to the people that already agree with you.
Yeah.
And if you want people to listen to you who may not have your point of view, all the more you should present a fair and educated and honest piece versus saying what you think makes you sound right.
Once you've written an editorial on a subject and made it very clear that you're an opponent of, say, you know, some project, some initiative, can you then, on the next day, go out and do a story on it for the news page?
You mean in the process, if they've written something, can we go ahead and publish it?
Well, let's say you've gone on record as opposing rail.
Mm-hmm.
Can you then do a story on rail and expect the people you talk to on both sides to trust you?
I would hope so, because I think we wouldn't publish an editorial that doesn't have the facts straight, that isn't fair to all sides of the story. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like if we are able to reflect integrity in our pieces, I don't think I think that we could expect that all sides would be willing to talk to us for a story.
Well, if somebody comes to me and I already know they you know, oppose the project that I'm backing,
yeah,
I don't want to talk to them.
Yeah,
right?
That's fair.
That's,
yeah,
a reporter whose opinions I'm now aware of.
Yeah. Well, so, I think then I would challenge my student, if they were in, you know, they were writing a story, to do their best. Mm-hmm. To still reach out and still have to engage in someone that might be on a different page as you, to do their best. Yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering if you can go back from the editorial page to objective reporting and have it expect to have it treated as objective reporting. You know, most newspapers tend to keep their editorial writers on the editorial page for that reason.
Right. Well, that's true. I mean, if I have a student that has a strong opinions about a matter and then they're going to write a news piece on that, mm-hmm, I wouldn't necessarily say, oh, you can't do that. But I think case by case, it depends on whether I think the student is capable of removing themselves, mm-hmm, removing sort of their opinion from being able to write a straight news piece. And I think that presents to me an opportunity, right, to,
yeah,
coach somebody to be able to learn a skill of sort of being objective and sort of removing their strong opinions, for setting aside for a moment,
yeah,
to inform people. Yeah.
Let's hope those skills are kept alive, Eunice.
I hope so. I hope so. Yeah.
Eunice Sim is a student newspaper advisor at Hawaii Baptist Academy, and you can learn more about her and her work on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for The Conversation comes from the Leeward Theater, presenting Shoot, Get Treasure, Repeat, a cycle of short plays examining the effects of war on modern life, opening 8 p.m. tomorrow. lcctheater.hawaii.edu.
With the legislature not in session today, we can only imagine there is still plenty of conversation happening over the rail bill. CivilBeat.org reporter Chad Blair is walking the halls of the Capitol, and he joins us now with today's reality check. Hi there.
Hi, Beth Ann.
Okay, so maybe you're back from the Capitol now, because I think we've got you.
Yeah,
on.
You can probably tell I sound nice and clear. There's
you
not
do.
People
okay.
Talking in the background.
So as you've been down there, though, and spending a great deal of time talking to lawmakers, and clearly we've got a huge divide between what the Senate wants and what the House is prepared to advance. At this point, we're still waiting for what happens today at 1 o'clock, when the governor will be having a press con. And then we had the letter today from the mayor is asking him to extend the session. Any word that you have, or anything that you've been able to hear, that might also mean that might be a likely outcome?
Well, they've only got one more day. Tomorrow is the last day, and something extraordinary would have to happen. They'd have to waive the rules for one side to basically cave in and take the other side. Both sides have said they are not going to give in. There's talk of compromise, yes, but they're pretty firm. And in a nutshell, the House is saying, look, we got to go with the hotel tax, extend the general excise tax a little bit, but really the hotel tax, a 1% increase, is the way to go for 10 years. Not so, says the Senate. The way is to extend the general excise tax for 10 years. There's a few other provisions in each of the two versions of the bill, but there does not seem much wiggle room for giving in here, and that's the big question. Only the governor or the leaders of the House and Senate, with the approval of two-thirds of their members, can actually order a special session. It's a very rare thing. Of course, we saw it for same-sex marriage. I don't picture a two-week, three-week session with lots of testimony. But there's no question this is the most important issue before voters, before our leaders, and we're going to have some answers within the next 24 hours.
So obviously, this is a lot of conjecture, but clearly, because they are so intractable on both sides, there's also the possibility that we end with nothing.
That is very possible. They could simply not come up with a bill, and then when that session would be called back in is not clear, presumably pretty soon. Maybe they would give everybody a little time off to breathe, maybe the weekend. Who knows? Maybe they would even work through the weekend. I do know that those conversations are being had right now with the leadership in both chambers, and the governor is certainly going to get that question first off during his press conference today.
Okay. All right. Well, at this moment, I think that's all we can say about it. We will wait and see. 1 o'clock's not that far away.
It sure is. Thanks, Beth.
All right. Talk to you later. Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org, today featuring reporter Chad Blair. Finding a cure for Alzheimer's disease may be a long way off. Finding an intervention drug for patients with a mild form of the disease, well, that may be closer to home. The 3-year worldwide Daybreak study is funded by pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly and Company, and it's looking for participants, including for the clinical trials at a Hawaii research center. Dr. Corey Liao is the director of the Hawaii Pacific Neuroscience Institute, and he's in our studio with us now. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
People hear Alzheimer's and become rightly afraid because we've seen so much of what happens when it occurs and what families have to go through with it. And then there are those drugs that keep being advertised and things that might mitigate or somehow slow the disease. But where are we exactly with research? How do you give people, if you will, a reality check of what we know research-wise now?
That's a great question, Pat. All the drugs that we have right now are what we call symptomatic treatment, meaning that it just mainly tries to improve things. It doesn't really address what's the underlying cause, what's really causing the Alzheimer's. What we're really getting excited about, some of the new studies, the new research that's happening right now, is that some of the research actually address the underlying cause, which is the buildup of the abnormal proteins in the brain. And we are trying to get the patients as well that are suitable candidates because we know that the longer that we wait, the more difficult it is to reverse some of the process.
The plaque that you talk about, the proteins that build up in the brain, it seems from what we're hearing now is that the attention is going to how do you now mitigate that as opposed to deal with some of the symptomatic issues. And that's what this study, as well as others that will be going on around the world, is set to address with this particular drug from Eli Lilly.
That's correct, Abed. What we realize now, by the time the patient developed memory loss or mild symptoms of Alzheimer's, you know, they probably had the plaque or the abnormal proteins build up in the brain for years, as long as 10 to 20 years. So a lot of the drugs that we are giving our patients, a lot of the approved drugs, have done very little to slow the progression. The driving driving force, or what I see as the future research in this field, is to really get to our patients earlier. You know, that means sometimes even before they develop memory loss. So the question is, if I don't have memory loss, why would I want to? How would I know? So some of the newer studies that we are really testing, including this current studies that we're testing, is we're looking for genetic markers. So we're looking for patients who are at high risk, and also patients who have proven by their spinal fluid where we don't have a good biomarkers yet, but the spinal fluid is one of the best biomarkers. We are drawing spinal fluid. We're testing for abnormal proteins and patients who are clearly at the very early stages of developing or on track to develop Alzheimer's. We're interested in speaking with them because we are really concentrating in seeing address some of the underlying cause.
Dr. Liao, as you look, though, at what people may take away from this, very clearly there isn't some sort of test that you can see whether you are predisposed for Alzheimer's now. I mean, you don't want to give anybody false hope about that.
That's correct. Unlike other disease like a prostate cancer, you have a PSA, ovarian cancer, colon cancer, you have very clear what we call biomarkers. Alzheimer's, we're not there yet. We're working very hard. The researchers are working very hard to try to identify some markers. The two main things that are on the forefront is, number one is looking at the abnormal proteins on PET scan, what we call flow beta field PET, for amyloid buildup in the PET scans. The second one is looking at abnormal proteins, the amyloid and the phosphorylated tau in the spinal fluid. So unfortunately, it's still an invasive test. We have to do a spinal tap with our patients to run for that. But those are the two most promising. But again, it's not a perfect technique yet.
As the Daybreak study is just now looking for participants, we have a long way to go for this study to be able to conclude itself. And in 3 years or so, we'll probably have more about that. But meanwhile, that's still time going by for people where they may be nervous or concerned, which goes back to lifestyle. What do you do? What can you do in the short term, in the interim, just in general, to be able to potentially head off your chances, even if you have particular markers?
Excellent questions. So as we don't have a cure, we don't have a definitive treatment yet. So the best thing that we can really do, if you have a family members with family history of Alzheimer's, or perhaps even at early stages, we have a lot of studies, a lot of evidence to suggest that lifestyle could play a role as well. For example, there is this study that shows that regular exercise, especially aerobic exercise, could slow the progression of the memory loss in Alzheimer's patient. And eating healthy, and reducing processed food,
And then very lately, though, we've seen that there was a study that linked greater consumption of sugar with a propensity to develop Alzheimer's, or at least being a potential cause or part of the cause?
Well, what we really know, Beth, is that whatever is going to be bad for the heart is going to be bad for the brain as well. So there's a very close relationship. So the fatty foods, the sugary food, that clog up the arteries in the heart, it's also going to clog up the arteries in the brain, So we realize that.
No more plate lunch.
No more loco moco for me.
Okay, so beyond that then, where do we take this as, lifestyle changes that people can make to be able to take care of heart and brain? Where do we go from here?
Well, a couple of things that are important. Number one is regular exercise. I always tell my patients, try to do at least 3 times a week. Even if it's 10 minutes, go for a walk. The second thing is I ask my patients to reduce their intake of meat, especially fatty food, reduce the intake of processed food, And also the third thing is if they are consuming alcohol, anything more than one glass of wine or beer is considered excessive. you know, and obviously if they're smoking, you know, to stop smoking, you know. And the other thing that I do want to bring up is dealing with some of the agitation in Alzheimer's patient, which are important as well, is
when you talk about agitation, forgive me for interrupting you, you're talking about a patient that already has Alzheimer's and what family members may be observing in this person who may have a completely changed personality and become very upset at things that never got them upset before, or sundowning other things that may happen at different times.
Right, right. And one of the difficulties being a neurologist caring for patients with this condition is the family bringing their mom or dad or uncle, auntie with Alzheimer's coming in a crisis mode because, you know, auntie is just, you know, freaking out, you know, and just not herself and belligerent, you know, being rude to the grandchildren, being danger. So one of the things that I wanted to advise my patients is always, you know, besides the lifestyle changes, and the family members can also make some lifestyle changes. You know, for example, learn not to argue with their loved ones with Alzheimer's. You know, you can't really try to reason with them. Just go along with it. That's the one. And then the second thing is, a lot of times some of this agitation are triggered by having a stranger in the house, you know, having a new gardener. You know, anything that's new or strange would tend to trigger this agitation.
Or a new caregiver.
Exactly.
All right, so be mindful of that. We have to wrap this up. Anything in particular that you want to make sure that you say, because you got about 10 seconds?
I do want to let them know that if they don't respond to this lifestyle changers, we do have also a study that addressed the agitation in Alzheimer's patient. So we have two great studies that we are on the forefront. So thank you so much for having me here.
Well, thank you, and good luck to you as both of these studies are now beginning. Dr. Corey Liao is the director of the Hawaii Pacific Neuroscience Institute and clinical professor of neurology at the University of Hawaii John Burns School of Medicine. To find out more about participating in either of the studies, you can check our Facebook page. That's The Conversation Hawaii Public Radio.
Aloha, I'm Karen Meyer from the Castle Performing Arts Center. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
In today's backyard quiz, we told you about a game played in pre-contact Hawaii that scandalized the missionaries and about the island where it was played. The game was called Ume Ume, and it paired off men and women for a night of love, even if they were married to others. After the missionaries put the kibosh on the mate swapping in the 1820s, the island came under control of the colorful Spanish entrepreneur Francisco de Paula Marin, who raised sheep, hogs, goats, and rabbits to supply his ship provisioning business. At mid-century, ownership of the island passed to a trust formed for the son of prominent Honolulu physician Dr. Seth Porter Ford, just before the Second World War became the property of the U.S. Navy. 70 aircraft were stationed there during the Pearl Harbor attack, of which 33 were destroyed. By now, you've guessed that we're talking about Ford Island, but we also ask for its Hawaiian name, which is Moku Ume Ume.
And Lolana Feinstemacher called us, and called from Kailua. This was a very popular quiz, but first is still first, and
as
that's
always,
what gets the prize. And if you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiianpublicradio.org, and you just might hear it on a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping strengthen the school-home connection with Home Edition, an online tool with reading and writing tailored to each student's ability. Achieve3000.com.
If you're a serious young actor with dreams of success, at some point you'll have to go to either New York or Los Angeles. And as likely as not, you'll be plunged into a whole new arena. You'll be competing with the best from around the country. You'll be dealing with a whole new class of people, producers, casting directors, and agents. Your past lifetime will need to be distilled to a first impression. And that's where the advice of a seasoned professional like New York-based agent Gary Epstein can prove invaluable. Gary's in town for a series of workshops at UH, and he's with us in our studio. Gary, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
That first impression is a pretty big deal in your profession, isn't it?
It certainly is, and it counts for a long time.
If you're not ready, what can that, you know, and you audition, say, and you present yourself to an agent, and you're just not ready, what can a bad first impression do to you?
Certainly change the agent's interest in wanting to represent you. The same thing probably with auditioning for casting directors and producers and directors.
Sure.
You got to be ready and figure out where you fit in the industry and who are you. It means taking a really long, dark look in the mirror. It's like intense therapy.
And always not particularly uncomfortable therapy either, I would think.
That is certainly correct.
You have to think about your limitations and your flaws, yeah?
You have to realize, who am I? Mm-hmm. And how do I present who I am in a really natural way?
It's difficult for anybody to be objective about who they are, right?
That is correct. You know, I started as a young actor myself, and I could not figure that stuff out. And thankfully, the light bulb went off early, and I was able to get a job as an agent, and I've been doing that for 40 years now.
How do you tell when somebody has a pretty good hold on who they are?
I listen to my intuition. I want to be moved. I want to laugh. I want to cry. It has mm-hmm. to be that deeply felt. It really mm-hmm. does.
Which is really, you know, now you're talking about something that's almost extra sensory. It's pretty hard to codify that.
That is certain. But you also have to take into consideration what Hollywood and New York City are looking for.
Yeah.
And what kind of projects they're casting. So you're looking to get the right kind of actor that can really act that is appropriate mm-hmm. during whatever time span they're in, you know?
And of course, what New York or Hollywood is looking for changes from year to year, yeah?
Ain't that the truth?
So what does that do for you? Does that just make you need to kind of see everything?
That certainly helps. You also run to all the graduating senior presentations from every theater program around the country mm-hmm. that comes to New York and to Los Angeles both during the spring. We're still about at the end of that right now.
I would think it would be an enormous temptation for somebody who had been a success locally and was surrounded by friends and family and people who came to their, you know, local theater productions to make that leap. And you know, if you're, you know, at home in Frostbite Falls, everybody thinks you're wonderful, right?
Yes.
And then in New York, everybody else is wonderful.
That's certainly one of the difficult aspects of this industry.
Yeah.
I think you don't really get a good sense of where you are in it or not until you're in it, mm-hmm. you know, for real.
You know, has Hollywood, I mean, you know, New York has always had a reputation, the theater world has always had a reputation for being extremely critical and you know, demanding lots of acting chops. Los Angeles, Hollywood, perhaps less so. I'm thinking of the song Hooray for Hollywood, where you're terrific if you're even good.
Yes.
That's changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. Although still, there are some aspects of Hollywood will look more for the guy that gets the girl and the girl that gets the guy than mm-hmm. we do necessarily in the theater world in New York. But, of course, they cast film and television in New York as well. So it's a juggle. It really
is. Yeah. Is Hollywood more likely to say, you know, you're a great-looking kid and we can work with you on the acting aspect?
I think you have to be ready and have those acting chops to get those opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you talk with students, as you have been at UH, what are the things they want to know?
Well, they're asking some of these same kind of questions. Mm-hmm. Do you think somebody at my age range and type will have an easy time of it in New York or Los Angeles? Do you think I'm ready? I have yet to actually see the auditions. That begins today and tomorrow.
Well, that'll be interesting.
Right now, it's just been a back and forth question and answer time the past couple of days. Mm-hmm. And just for the basic information about how the industry works.
Well, the audition phase is going to be very interesting, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And obviously, in Hawaii, you're going to see more of the more Asian Americans.
Well,
and we've been seeing a changing climate for Asians in film, haven't we? Film and theater.
We certainly have. And I'm kind of struck by the multi-ethnic kids that are in this program. It's not anything that I have been used to. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't see that in New York, really. You don't. I'm talking about Asians and other South Pacific, you know, humans that are in these programs. It's pretty amazing to me.
Well, we have a lot of people in Hawaii who are combinations of any number of ethnicities, and by extension could probably play any number of ethnicities.
I totally agree. In fact, there's one youngster that I met the other day, and I made an assumption that she was Latina, but she was from Tonga.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, that's a plus, because you can play more than just one ethnicity.
Yeah.
That'll help you in the biz.
And you think the biz is getting more open to that?
It's taken a long time, but yes, I do. And it's an upside to the industry, in my view. No getting around it.
Pretty hard to tell where anything is going, as you said. But certainly, I wonder if, you know, the whole emphasis in Hollywood on the action hero, I wonder how much a future that has got, you know, how many more explosions you can pack in, you know, because the formula has been sort of explosion followed by kind of a smart alecky remark.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been going for a while now.
Yeah, it has. Well, I guess I wouldn't say that our industry is the most politically correct of industries, you know, but I think they do what they need to do. And sometimes they realize we have to step up and eliminate the alternative facts.
Yeah. Pretty interesting profession for you to be in, isn't it, Gary?
It's been an interesting ride. It really has. It's like I'm a lucky guy. I don't think there's many things like that on the planet. And it's been always up and down for everybody. It's kind of interesting in that way as well.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating. It really has been.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Chris. A pleasure to make your acquaintance.
Gary Epstein will be running workshops on career preparation and holding auditions this Friday from 1 to 5 p.m. at Kennedy Theater on the UH Manoa campus on behalf of the UH Manoa Department of Theater and Dance.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, now accepting applications for summer school featuring camps on drone photography and filmmaking for girls and boys in preschool through grade 12. SacredHearts.org.
There's always a lot going on in our state that's a little bit under the radar, and that's where we count on Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama to take a look at some of those events.
Yes.
Hi, Derek. Thanks for coming
Hello.
In.
Yes, let's take a look here.
What do we got cooking today?
Okay. UH Hilo is hosting a CD release concert. This is happening tomorrow. It's in celebration of the release of a new album by Professor T and the East Side Shredders. The album features UH Hilo professor Trevor Villeux on guitar and vocals, and performances from several members of the school's jazz orchestra. The concert will also feature dance and original choreography by Dori Yamada. It's in the UH Hilo Performing Arts Center tomorrow at 7:30. Visit our website for ticket information.
Eastside Shredders.
Yeah, that's an original name.
It certainly is. And Cinco de Mayo is coming up, isn't it?
Yeah, and also Boys Day. We have a lot to celebrate coming up on Friday. And it's also First Friday in downtown Honolulu and Chinatown, when art galleries and cafes stay open late. First Friday at the Hawaii State Art Museum will feature live performances by members of the Hawaii Opera Theater, and the museum will be open from 6 to 9 p.m. It's free and family-friendly.
I've been to some of those on a Friday night. Those are a lot of fun.
Yes, they are.
And here's a musical that's going to pack 80 students onto the stage.
Right, but they won't be on stage at the same time. Iolani School is staging Beauty and the Beast Jr., bringing the Disney movie to the Mamiya Theater. The 80 students will be separated into three different casts. This song show is for the entire family, recommended for ages 4 and up. It's Friday, this Friday, at 7 p.m. in the Mamiya Theater on the campus of St. Louis School. Go to our website for a link to tickets, and they're also available at the door. The tickets are.
I figured that was much.
Yeah.
Derek, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might just be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Well, that's going to do it for us for this day, in preparation for what may yet come tomorrow. We're going to talk on Town Square with Neil Milner and Colin Moore, and I hope you'll join me for what may or may not be a legislative wrap-up.
And we'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
That'll get you to me. And if you missed any part of the show or just want to listen to something else again, find it on The Conversation page. It's got links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow for Town Square.